From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. After 150 years, The Nation magazine decided they needed a sports writer. So they chose Dave Zirin. He's the host of a radio show, Edge of Sports, on the Sirius XM satellite network. He's been called one of Utney Reader's 50 visionaries who are changing our world. And his new book is titled Game Over: How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down.
Take me out to the ballgame. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack.
Okay, so we just did our seventh inning stretch here on The Conversation as we round the corner and head for home. Dave, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I want to talk about the excitement here in Seattle over an NBA team coming back. The group led by Chris Hansen and Microsoft's Steve Ballmer reportedly made a $30 million down payment, unrefundable, to the owners of the Sacramento Kings. But there's a group in Sacramento that says they're going to mount a counteroffensive here. They're going to try to come up with their own offers. The NBA owners are going to vote on this by April 19th. Should Seattleites have any doubt this is going to go through?
Oh, I think they absolutely should have doubt that it'll go through. I would put it at about 75% that Seattle will eventually land the Sacramento Kings and have a good young franchise here. The question is complicated by the fact that the mayor of Sacramento is former NBA All-Star Kevin Johnson, who has a lot of sway with the NBA Board of Governors. Part of the problem, though, is that Kevin Johnson is trying to craft a deal that's so favorable to NBA ownership that it's actually upsetting the locals in Sacramento and statewide in California, which is having, of course, its own economic problems. And the idea of a massive public welfare splurge to keep the Sacramento Kings is not something that's going over very well.
Now, does that make any difference to the NBA owners, who I understand will be making the decision? If there's a sweet deal to keep the team in Sacramento, does that sway them to maybe go along with it?
It certainly does, because there's such this idea of not wanting to set bad precedents for ownership. And I think people in Seattle know this very well. I think the folks in Seattle were actually heroic several years back when they said, you know what, we just gave public money for the Mariners. We just gave public money for a new stadium for the Seahawks. We have stadium fatigue. The arena is not that old, and there's no reason why the Seattle Supersonics, who are an absolute institution and a former NBA champion, should have to move from the Emerald City. Now, NBA owners, particularly David Stern, did not want to set the precedent that when they ask for stadium money, they don't get it. And they made the people of Seattle pay a price for that. And I think people in Seattle should still be very wary of the National Basketball Association. And I think, frankly, David Stern's name should be mud in this town as long as he's commissioner of the National Basketball Association. But it does look good, because the other factor is that Seattle, it's a wealthy city. It's a city with people with casual income. It's a city with a tremendous basketball tradition. And David Stern, who is going to retire after 30 years as commissioner next year, he does not want part of his legacy to be the guy who stole basketball from Seattle.
Dave Zirin is my guest. We're at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW if you've got a question for him. 800-289-5869. You can write to conversation at KUOW.org. Now, the new book, Game Over, about politics and sports. Since it was published, a former NBA star, Dennis Rodman, went to North Korea, and the worm wants President Obama to call Kim Jong-un. Is this the beginning of sports star as freelance international political diplomat?
Well, it's certainly something we've seen before. I mean, Muhammad Ali visited Saddam Hussein in 1990 before the 91 Gulf War. So it's not the first time an athlete has played this kind of role. In the broader sense, people might be familiar with the phrase ping-pong diplomacy, which helped open relations between the United States and China. So sports historically has been used as a way to create bridges between nations. Now, Dennis Rodman has been subject to a lot of criticism for this trip, and he was subject to a withering interview by George Stephanopoulos on this week. But I got to tell you, I will not bury Dennis Rodman for this trip. I will praise him for two reasons. One, because Dennis Rodman made this trip, people are actually talking about North Korea, and people who are looking at reports about this, for example, ESPN just did a long report where they interviewed a Korean professor from the University of Georgia, who's an expert on North Korea. I mean, so people are smarter about North Korea, other than just thinking axis of evil, dictatorship, nuclear power. And it actually has the effect of humanizing a place that I think our government has thingified and treated as something less than human. The second thing is that George Stephanopoulos is now on record as having said to Dennis Rodman, why didn't you ask about human rights violations? Why didn't you ask about the prisons? And so now I think that's the standard we can hold George Stephanopoulos to. Every time he talks to a world leader, including our own leaders of this country, I'll expect him to ask about our own system of mass incarceration the next time he speaks to somebody from the Obama administration.
But Dennis Rodman, great basketball player, also known for wearing wedding dresses and rather eccentric behavior, is he the kind of a guy who brings credibility to sports figures being active in politics?
Well, first of all, wedding dress can look good on any occasion, so that's won't blast him for that. But the second point is, no, Dennis Rodman is not a serious political person the way we would understand Billie Jean King or Arthur Ashe or Ali or Jim Brown as being serious political people. There's a 21-year-old player in the NBA right now named Royce White who's been speaking out about mental health issues, who's a far more serious and intelligent person than Dennis Rodman. But it's not about what Dennis Rodman is, who he is. It's about what that represents and what it produces, and about the fact that he may not have the intellectual capital to go over there and have a debate about human rights and then kick George Stephanopoulos' butt on This Week or something like that. But what he does have is cultural capital. And he has cultural capital with a dictator in Kim Jong-un, who is an absolute basketball obsessive. His whole family is. Madeleine Albright once brought his father a signed basketball from Michael Jordan on the advice of some of the leading figures in the State Department, because they knew that would be a way to start discussion. So if someone could use their cultural capital, frankly, to do more than just sell us things with swooshes on them, I think that's something to be welcomed.
Dave Zirin's with me. His new book is about politics and sports. It's called Game Over. You write that one way the sports business has grown to become so massive and so wealthy is that it portrays the players as apolitically as possible. Why do you think that's been a key to its success?
Well, because then you don't confront people with controversial issues in as broad a way as possible. You create these kind of blank slates who are these one-dimensional heroes. It's what Bob Lipside called the godding up of athletes. But what we've seen in recent years, and this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is that there's also a price to pay when you god up athletes so much and treat them as these apolitical, one-dimensional figures, because when they fall from grace, the fall is particularly acute and particularly harmful to the sports industrial complex. I mean, look at Nike's campus at Beaverton, Oregon is a great example of this. In the last year, they've had to rename the Lance Armstrong Fitness Center. They can't call it that anymore. And they've had to rename the Joe Paterno Child Care Center. Can't call it that anymore. And they've had to take down from their website Oscar Pistorius, the South African runner who's now on trial for murdering his girlfriend. They had a commercial with him where he looks at the camera and says, "I am the bullet in the gun." And now they can't show that anymore. So when you got up these athletes, you also then run the risk, especially in our 24-hour sports information culture with Twitter and Facebook and social media, that when they fall from grace, people are shocked to see that their heroes were actually three-dimensional, at times deeply flawed people.
But why does their fall from grace any steeper if they're not involved in politics than it would have been otherwise? I mean, Joe Paterno, it wasn't his politics that got him in trouble.
Exactly. But it was the one-dimensional view of him as this very, almost vanilla, heroic figure, like this father of this entire, not just university, but of the entire state of Pennsylvania. If there had been real sports reporting about Joe Paterno over the decades, we would have seen somebody who, frankly, it makes a lot more sense that he might be part of in a cover-up to protect the football institution. I think it still would have shocked everybody that he would have been part of something so monstrous as what Jerry Sandusky was involved with, the rape of children. But the idea of somebody who's so ambitious, so competitive, and at times so angry to people he views as challenging his authority, that's been a part of Joe Paterno rule at Penn State for decades. Yet we didn't see that because of a kind of symbiotic relationship between sports business and sports media, which often covers over the flaws in our heroes.
Dave Zirin, you make the argument in this book that we're seeing this flourishing of political activism among sports figures, major sports figures. Is that to say that the owners and those who wanted to keep the athletes out of politics have largely been successful up until recent years?
Yeah. Oh, they've been very successful.
How have they done that? How have they been able to do that?
Well, one way, the most obvious way, is just holding over players' heads the fact that their time in the spotlight is very finite. I mean, the typical NFL career is 3 to 4 years. Major League Baseball and the NBA, it runs anywhere from 5 to 8 years. And so basically, you're talking about a very short window to earn the majority of money you will ever earn in your entire life, often from athletes from very poor backgrounds. And so you hold over their head the idea of being drummed out of the sport. And I've been able to interview a lot of NBA players, and two names that a lot of players know are two players who are not going to the Hall of Fame, but they're known, and their names are Craig Hodges and Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. And what they both have in common, they were 1990s basketball players who were drummed out of the league for taking political stands. And it's the sort of thing that's held over players' heads. You don't want this to be you. You don't want to risk even 1 year of income, which could make the difference in whether or not you're broke when you're 50.
Are they really tossing players out of major league sports who are performing well because they're politically active?
That has happened. I mean, or they lose endorsements. That's the other thing that's taken place. Rashard Mendenhall, who's the number one running back for the Pittsburgh Steelers, he lost all of his endorsements when he made comments after the assassination of bin Laden about saying, like, I don't necessarily endorse us all celebrating the fact that bin Laden is dead. You know, this is not something that I necessarily agree with, but that's not the point about whether we agree or disagree with. The point is that he was penalized financially for exercising free speech. And that's something that players are extremely conscious of. But there's a flip side to it, too, which is part of what I'm arguing in the book, is that in the age of social media and also in the age of protracted crisis, which we've seen since the economic fallout from 2008, you have more and more athletes who find themselves almost unable to stay apolitical, given both what's happening in the world and given their opportunity to go around the filter of old-fashioned sports media and just have themselves be heard directly to the public.
Dave Sirens with me. We're talking about his book, Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. If you've got a question, if you'd like to challenge him on this, or you'd like to hear more, 206-543-5869, 800-289-5869. This isn't the first time we've seen politics in sports. You're the co-author of the John Carlos story.
Sure.
About the African-American track and field athlete who won the bronze medal and then did the Black Power salute on the podium with Tommy Smith. It caused such a giant controversy. But you're making the argument here that we're seeing that a lot these days. Give us a few examples that people who don't follow sports closely might not be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, I would be negligent if I didn't mention that I was here a year ago with John Carlos when we wrote the book, and we filled out the African American Museum. We had packed house, so terrific support from Seattle, and also obviously a lot of young people seeing sports and politics as being a relevant issue, which is why they would come out to see John Carlos. Let's just look at what just happened with the Super Bowl, for example. In the lead up to the Super Bowl, the big discussion was not so much about the 49ers versus the Ravens. The discussions, first of all, were about gay rights, because one of the players for the Ravens, Brendan Iambadejo, said that he wanted to use the media attention around the Super Bowl to speak about anti-bullying and to speak about marriage equality. And on the flip side, you had players for the San Francisco 49ers, when asked by the press about it, who said very homophobic things, which had an extra edge when you consider that they play for the San Francisco 49ers, which not only San Francisco, of course, a mecca of the LGBT community, but also San Francisco 49ers being the first NFL team to film what are called the It Gets Better videos against anti-LGBT bullying. And it was so bad that Dan Savage, who started the It Gets Better project, actually took the 49ers video down from the website, first time they've ever done that. So that's one recent example. Another recent example to me, and this is looking very globally here, are the soccer clubs in the Middle East right now, particularly in Egypt. And I have a whole chapter about it in the book, that they have emerged from being these very apolitical, often very violent, very male, very macho youth societies, basically, that were often used to blow off steam during periods of tension in the country. Like after a soccer game, Mubarak, the leader of Egypt, would say, yeah, sure, go out, fight people, do whatever you have to do, and tell the police, just fight them in the streets, but we're not going to put them in jail. Meanwhile, if you went out with a protest sign, you could find yourself in prison. They actually became very politicized by by the Arab Spring. And you saw that also happen in Bahrain, where athletes and fans took to the streets against the Al Khalifa monarchy there. You saw it happen in Libya. And this in and of itself, you're definitely seeing it happen in Gaza and the West Bank right now. The Palestinian national soccer team has taken on a very political role there. So what part of the argument is that when you see periods of struggle blow up, you do see it reflect itself in the world of sports.
Dave Zirid, in Game Over, a lot of these examples are from the progressive politics side. You write for The Nation. That's clearly where your sympathies lie. But people expressing political views does not guarantee that they will express progressive political views. Do you think if they were unfettered political expression amongst major sports figures, these are wealthy people, one might think that there would be a fair amount of fairly conservative expression of political views if they were unfettered.
And you do get that. Tim Thomas, the goaltender for the Boston Bruins, famously refused to go to the White House after the team won the Stanley Cup, and he put out a statement in support of the Tea Party on his website, or I'm sorry, on Facebook, actually, for people to see about why he wasn't going to do it. And at that time, what I said is always been my position, which is I totally support Tim Thomas's right to not go to the White House and be the prop for a photo opportunity with the president if that's not something that he wants to do. And that's a very important thing, because to me, the enemy, it's not that the enemy of left speech is right-wing speech. To me, it's free speech versus athletes who feel like they've really signed away their rights to be three-dimensional human beings, to be citizens, to actually have something that they want to say about the world just because they are athletes and feel like they're under the thumb of management.
But do you think that if they were all expressing themselves freely, the progressive politics of some who we've heard from might simply be neutralized by the less progressive politics of others? If they were all speaking out, doesn't it just become, well, professional sports athletes like all of us have different views on politics?
I think it would represent a flowering of democracy and discussion in our society. I think one of the great ails of this country is that we think that the only people who are allowed to be political are the folks on Capitol Hill with the bad haircuts, and that's who politics is outsourced to. When you have people in culture who are speaking out about politics, I think it has a net positive effect, even if the result is a lot of noise. We'll just have to use Nate Silver's term, find the signal in the noise.
You also say that this could be, though, what you call, I think, the canary in the coal mine when it comes to political expression in our country. Why is that?
Well, the canary in the coal mine, it's a phrase used by the sports sociologist Dr. Harry Edwards. And what he argues, and what I totally agree with, is that sports is often prefigurative in our society, and that what happens in sports is a signal of what's going to happen in our society. The most famous example is Jackie Robinson desegregating Major League Baseball in 1947, when you don't have the Montgomery bus boycotts until 1955. And Dr. King called Jackie Robinson a sit-inner before sit-ins, a freedom rider before freedom rides. Ali came out against the war in Vietnam back when the war was still hugely and widely popular in the country. And I think what you're seeing today is a lot of athletes, the fact that they're beginning to emerge from their cocoon and speak out, I think it's like the canary in the coal mine in that it prefigures the fact that you're going to see more movements for gay rights, to use this example. I think you have women athletes who are starting to now push back against kind of raunch culture in the way that's become part of sports, like the Playboy's Women of the Olympics issue being one prominent example of that, or Danica Patrick, the race car driver, posing in Maxim magazine and things like that. And I think that also prefigures the fact that you're going to, I think, see more of a reaction against raunch culture, against sexism in our culture as well.
Dave Zirin, you read him in The Nation. His new book is called Game Over: How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. Thank you so much for coming by. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my privilege. Thank you.
Our program produced by David Hyde with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Amber Cortez. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.